This is Meatless, a podcast about eating. I'm Alicia Kennedy, a food and drink writer. I'll be having conversations with chefs, writers, and more about how their personal and political beliefs determine whether or not they eat meat. The show will ask the question, how do identity, culture, economics, and history affect a diet? In this episode, I talked to food scientist Dr. Cheryl Mitchell, the person who developed Rice Dream and the Elmhurst Milked line of nut, grain, and seed milks. We discussed how she came to focus on vegan milks, the hydro-release process she created, and why we need to diversify protein sources in order to keep feeding the human population. Thank you, Dr. Cheryl Mitchell, for being on Meatless with me and taking the time out of your day.
No problem. Thank you, Alicia.
Can you tell me about where you grew up and what you ate?
I think you're the first one that asked me that question in particular. I grew up in New Jersey, and my father was also a food scientist working for General Foods, and so many people know him because he's the inventor of Pop Rocks.
Wow.
And but also he did the invention for Cool Whip and Cool and Creamy and what makes Tang Tang. So he was a food scientist, but I grew up, he had quite a large garden, let's call it. I would say it's a mini farm, actually. So we raised all our own vegetables, and he was a big flower person, too. And I think growing up, having always fresh vegetables and understanding the importance of, and he did a lot of the cooking, too. So growing up in the kitchen with him, every part, I think that's what stunned me the most, was every part of the vegetables, once they've been cleaned and starting in the cooking process, he used in the cooking. So if you cooked some vegetables and you steamed them, the steamed water would be used in another part of the preparation. Mm-hmm. So nothing was wasted. And he would always comment about the minerals and the values in every part of the raw material that we were using, that there was should be nothing that should be thrown away. And certainly there wasn't. I'm the youngest of seven children. And food was very precious always. And I think that's impacted me the most. And the second thing was, later in my life, I also worked for General Foods for a while. So I had the pleasure of working with my father from time to time. And I became aware of taking things from benchtop. It's one thing to make fudge, let's say, on benchtop. But think about if you had to make that same fudge at 10,000 pounds at a time, as it would be in a commercial operation to distribute food worldwide and to stabilize the food. So it became a different question. And so that's where I leaned most of my career, as it turned out, with regards to how to commercialize and make available highly nutritious foods without, you know, using chemicals or additives or anything else, because it just wasn't necessary. We could do this by the process, and it was just a matter of figuring out how.
Right, right. And so you come from, you know, your father being the inventor of these foods that are kind of, you know, they're definitely not nut milk.
We had many discussions about that one.
So why did you decide to focus on plant-based milks in your career?
It started out, actually my PhD is in chemistry, and I was developing carcinostatic drugs, basically drugs that would stop cancer. And so it was more related, and was interested in the carbohydrates and how that works and everything. So I was, a pretty strong medical and focus on the metabolism of carbohydrates and foods in general. And, you know, in figuring out how our body handles them, I also thought about how we would process them, very similar to how the body needed to process them and how it worked to process the foods. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's just after the experience with Imagine Foods and basically Robert was so focused at that time on getting the nutrition, but getting a good quality food material. And that's where I really learned about the natural foods and has a very healthy respect for the industry that was just really starting up at that time. And so I just really focused on anything I did, focused on maximizing nutrition and getting it in a form that could be distributed worldwide.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to work with Imagine Foods and on the Rice Dream product? And what was the inspiration for Rice Dream?
Okay. I started working on the Rice Dream because of a meeting with Imagine Foods and Robert Nissenbaum and Kenny Becker, who were partners at the time. Robert was the one that had the restaurant. He was making the Amazaki, but knew that he couldn't make large quantities of it, which he really wanted to distribute and stabilize it. He actually went to a company called Chico San. You might remember Chico San from the rice cakes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, they were in the process of being sold, but they were the first ones actually to try to make rice syrup in this country. And Robert had gone to them to see if they would make the Amazaki, which he knew that they were going through the Amazaki to make the rice syrup. They were struggling so much with making the rice syrup from the Amazaki that they said they contacted us, meaning myself and my husband, and said, "Can you do this?" And at that time, I said, "Yeah, let me see what you're doing, and I'm sure we can improve this and make it more commercialized." And that's really what started the whole process. They didn't want to make it there. We started set up our facility to make it for them. Chico San was then bought by Heinz. Heinz didn't want anything to do with the rice syrup or the rice milk. I'm sure they regret that decision right now, but that was their thinking at the time. They were trying to deal with the marketing, and of course there was a surge of all of a sudden. Even though the rice cakes had been out there for 10 years, all of a sudden the consumers thought, "Oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread," and the rice cake market started taking off. So they didn't want to have anything to do with the rice milk. They didn't understand the rice syrup, they didn't understand the rice milk, and they didn't understand what Robert was trying to accomplish. And so that left Robert and I and my first company, California Natural Products, to figure out how we were going to make the product and package it aseptically. And so we just took on those challenges and moved forward. So that's how we came into play. The difficulty was that Robert had been making a very traditional Amazaki.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional Amazaki has all the fiber and pulp. And he knew that for this market, we really needed to start with brown rice was his goal and maximizing the nutrient value. The problem was in the processing and trying to put it into an aseptic container. Requires a lot of instantaneous heat. So you're bringing up to high temperatures very quickly and also cooling it very fast. Well, those type of heat exchangers would be plugged very quickly by the fiber. And so we pulled out the fiber. But with the pulling out of the fiber, we also realized the protein was going out with the fiber. And there wasn't anything we could do about that at the time. So we went that route. We also went to using white rice because we couldn't handle the or stabilize the oils, the natural oils in the brown rice. And so the product would oxidize very quickly. So we got rid of the, started using the white rice and adding the safflower oil to make an emulsion. And then we had to use the various gums and stabilizers to keep everything in suspension. It was a product that served its purpose, meaning that people and consumers became aware for the first time that there could be something other than soy milk, that we could have rice milk. For people having allergies, and that's we promoted it to people that were looking for something that was hypoallergenic. And the rice milk worked very, very well and worked for many, many people. So for the next 20 years, in fact, the patents that I wrote for those and got for the, development were in use and for the next 20 years. Just on the rice milk. But that's where I deviated because knowing what I had to do to make the rice stream work, including adding a lot of calcium carbonate to make it so it wasn't translucent, that it was more opaque, it was just wrong. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I could do better given a little bit more time. So after spending the time with my first company, California Natural Products, I sold my half and I took my research team and I said, look, I used all my money and I said, we are going to figure out how to maximize the nutritional value of every grain, nut, and seed we can get our hands on. And we're going to figure out how to do it in a very mechanical approach way. I said, This business about grinding to a flour or grinding to a paste, which has been going on for the last 2,000 years, is not the right approach. And starting with that premise and the premise of getting everything in from the raw material, all the nutrients in, that's what we started working on. And it was a mechanical process and a huge change in how we first started working with raw materials. And that became the hydro release process.
Right. And can you explain how that allows for nut and grain milks without added gums and thickeners, which are so prevalent in most milks?
Right. And they're prevalent in most milks because that's it's mostly water. They can't get enough of the grain, nut, or seed in there without fouling the heat exchangers or processors. So that's why they started using less and less of the raw material and more stabilizers and gums to make it seem like there was a lot of the raw material in there. Our process is different because with the hydro release, we are taking, and I liken it to power washing, so that you're separating each of the natural compositions in the raw material. So we start with the raw material. This is not, these are viable grains, nuts, and seeds. And there, when you use this power washing, you're kind of sloughing off, just like layer at a time, the composition, the carbohydrates, the oils are released, and the natural micronutrients, which are really critical. This is your lecithins, your vitamins, your minerals, all of these, once released, start to recombine in a different way. And the most important one at separation is also the proteins from the fiber. And we realized that we needed to keep the fibers very long because in making a milk-type product, you do want to remove the fibers, which, by the way, we do utilize those fibers and other ingredients. So all the ingredients everything that comes in is used. So there's no waste. Mm-hmm. But the rest of it, the proteins that are liberated, well, oh my gosh, they start to behave really uniquely. And that was very important for us because first of all, they become, I call them soft proteins. Once liberated from the fiber, instead of being an aggregate and a kind of a hard, chewy aggregate, they become very, very soft. They hydrate very well, and they kind of float on their own. They, you know, you don't need to keep them in suspension. They kind of prefer to be in a suspension anyway. And especially when you've got the natural oils have also been released along with the natural lecithins. This gets back to the simpler, better. If you're allowing the raw material has pretty much all these constituents in it, but nobody was thinking in terms of releasing them so they can do their job that they would normally do. And for the last 50 years in food science, all we've been doing is really putting a lot of people in business, making a lot of ingredients, when in fact, all we had to do was take one of the basic ingredients and keep everything there, but liberate them so that they would have more functionality. And that's what makes the milked products and the Elmhurst milked products so special, because we've done that in these milks and you can taste it, the creaminess. And this is the unsweetened varieties only have two ingredients, the power of two, just water and the raw material. And when you taste it, you're going to sit there and say, oh my gosh, it doesn't really need anything else.
Mm-hmm. And you originally called the hydro release process a cold milking, which I think is interesting. What is the origin of that phrase?
Yeah, well, you know, here we are trying to market the product. And at first, I think everybody said, well, it's a cold. I think they used the term milking and they used the term milling. And I kept on saying, no, this is a milling process. So we got to get that out. But you hit on a very important point. When you are trying to educate the consumers as to what this technology is, that's where we came up. He said, well, you've got to come up with a name. And I said, well, it's kind of like, you know, power washing. And that's where we started on coming up with a name like hydro release, water release. We're using water to release all the different components of the grains, nuts, and seeds. And in that liberation process, we have a totally different material. Here's the thing too. The fact that the proteins are released in this way is what makes them work and function so much different. So you don't need the, you can do the same function as, say, a lot of the things in dairy milks. Mm-hmm. We haven't even touched on that all the week. Research-wise, we're getting there because we can ferment them to make yogurts, to make cheeses, to do everything because our proteins are definitely released. And so they automatically ferment just as the same way milk does. The cream that we're making, a hemp cream and a peanut cream that is actually cream. Mm-hmm. That's, these creamers that are out there are just formulated type of products where our product is actually the cream. No different than dairy milk has dairy cream.
Right.
Okay. And what that is, when you take the milk from the cow and then put it through a creamery separator, well, we do the exact same thing. After everything's released, there's certain soluble proteins that like to go with the fat part. And sure enough, we put it through the creamery separator and voila, you have an actual cream.
Wow, that's amazing.
it is. I can't tell you. This is so exciting because of the similarities.
Right.
To the dairy market.
Right. And so the dairy lobby doesn't want these products to be called milk, and I'm sure they wouldn't want them to be called cream either. What is your response to that dairy lobby movement around not calling plant-based milks milk?
Okay, even with Gottlieb's address on the issue and everything, in a way, he's got a point with regards to nutrition. If the dairy milk has been the gold standard because of the protein content, the quality of the protein in the dairy milk. However, as the consumers have trended and necessarily trended to a plant-forward situation and consumer trend of the flexitarians and the just flip plant forward in general, it's for different reasons, health, ethical, and environmental mm-hmm. reasons. The reality is we have to trend that way with the growing population in particular. Mm-hmm. While we're very protein positive now, the nutrition, as time goes on, and by 2030, 2040, we have a serious situation with regards to a prospective protein deficiency. So mm-hmm. we have to look at other sources. And this is an evolution. So it's not a revolution, as mm-hmm. I keep on pointing out to everybody. This isn't going to happen overnight. This is an evolution where we have to really embrace the diversity of our raw materials, whether it's dairy or whether it's from plants. We're basically broadening our epicurean lifestyle to include some very unique new ingredients and products that can diversify our culinary outlook. And that is where, that's the importance. That's where we're going right now. And that's what this product has done. Now, in the past, when you referred to it as milk, that was a good transitional to allow the consumers to realize. In fact, there's some funny stories about that, because after the rice milk, we had gone out there and asked people and saying, well, do you know what oat milk is? Or do you know what? And these things hadn't been developed yet. We had, but a lot of the other things, oat milk, and then we started throwing in, well, what about pecan milk or pistachio milk? Oh, yeah, I know what that is. And they could describe it exactly. They've never seen it before, but they understood, using the term milk, that this was a product that looked like milk, that could function at least over cereal. And really earlier on, 70% of the usage of even rice milk was over cereal. So that people were just looking for a replacement. What we've done is really a quantum leap. This is a nutritive plant milk. This is different from the other earlier milks that I would call non-nutritive, when you have a low calorie, 30, 60, this is non-nutritive milks. Mm-hmm. Ours is a nutritive plant milk. It is a new category. And even with the two ingredients, but we put a lot of nuts, sometimes people ask, well, it's expensive. Well, really, on a nut per nut basis, ours is much cheaper because we're giving you a lot more nutrition for your dollar.
Right.
And as the time goes on, it's going to be about that, the biggest bang for your nutritional buck.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And someone asked me, they're about to wean their child off of breast milk. Is plant-based milk safe for babies? Is it giving them as much nutrition as a dairy milk would?
That's a good question. At this point, the nutrition of both non-dairies and plant-based or any other, even soy milk, there's a lot of fortification. We mm-hmm. chose not to fortify our products because we felt the consumers actually were doing a better job diversifying. They know, and you're not going to get all the nutrition when we're talking about vitamin A or D. Those are very special vitamins. Some of them are natural in different raw materials. But usually people are diversifying what they're consuming to get a nice diversity. They're not depending on getting all their calcium from just the milk. The calcium comes from a lot of different food products that they also eat. So it becomes questionable as to Whether we should have fortified or not, I'm willing to give them something simpler and let them make the decision of what they would like to fortify and what they would like to use in their diversity of foods that they're consuming.
Right, right, right. And you talked a bit about the need in the future to diversify protein sources, and also that at Elmhurst, you're not wasting anything. There is often discussion around whether plant-based milks are sustainable in terms of like land, water, and energy usage. What is your perspective on that? And what does Elmhurst specifically do to combat that?
Oh, yeah, thank you for that question. basically, there's a term I keep on using and throwing out here to the marketing folks. I said, look, sustainability is all about diversity, and we're talking about plant diversity. Mm-hmm. So imagine for the last 50 years, you have milk in your refrigerator, okay, because that was your go-to protein source. Mm-hmm. Well, what if you could have a protein source from not just almonds, and they got stuck on again one crop, and that's why we immediately, with the Elmhurst line, diversified mm-hmm. and said, no, we're not just depending on almonds. We can give you protein from walnuts, from oats, from hazelnuts, from cashews, from rice, and from hemp. We can do it all, and that way it's your choice what you want to what works for you, and that gets into the nutrigenomic thing as well. Not everybody's body is the same. So you might have more of a need for omega-3s. Another person might be more in need of the beta-glucans and the fiber from the whole oat. Somebody else might, like me, I like the rice for the hypoallergenic portion of it, but also that's my go-to for if I'm definitely replacing milk in a bechamel sauce, that's what I use. So everybody's got something different that they're requiring. And with the Elmhurst line, you can pick and choose and put it there. You don't have to have just 1 gallon of milk. You can have four different types of milked grains, nuts, or seeds to put in your refrigerator.
Right, right. That's something I tell a lot of people about people who think that veganism or, you know, cutting out dairy is a strange thing to do. It's like, well, you can have so much more if you open yourself up to this kind of these products. You don't have to
And you're absolutely right on that. My husband's a prime example of this one. My daughter is vegan, mm-hmm. and she every time she comes, the first thing out of his mouth is, "Oh man, we're not going to be able to eat anything." And I said, "You haven't learned yet that there is so much that you are eating that is vegan." It would it's so easy to use these products, and I've made them. So when she comes and it's holidays, virtually, other than if we do have the turkey, everything else in the meal is vegan, mm-hmm. and he's slowly has begun to realize the significance of the fact that, you know, and the more you eat these other type of foods that, in fact, our chef here made a macaroni and cheese and entered it into a contest and placed either second or third. The interesting thing of it, he didn't tell anybody that vegan, that macaroni and cheese he did was vegan.
Wow. What did he use in it, in the cheese? Do you know?
He was using the Daiya.
Oh, okay. Okay. Point.
And we're still looking at, we think we could even, you know, with the products that we're doing, with the, you know, we could even make a more superior. So stay tuned on that one.
I would love to see that because I'm not a big fan of Daiya. I know it's a cheap and ubiquitous option, but it's not my favorite taste-wise uh-huh. or texture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think what added to the taste and flavor was on the replacement of the dairy milk with the milked nuts, nice. The Elmer's nuts, and It really did add a very significant flavors, but that's where even getting into the milked peanuts, by the way, for sustainability, this is really critical. The peanuts are one of our most nutritious crops that we have, and it's an annual crop. So this is very important that we really maximize the benefit. And the protein shakes that are out there now, and the peanut cream and the peanut milks, which really have all kinds of applications in cooking and making curries and sauces and whatnot, that you would never have dreamed to be using the a peanut milk. But people are changing, and as I said, it'll take a little while, but this is, after all, just an evolution. And what I keep on trying to tell people, that, you know, the bulk of us are flexitarian. Even if you replace your cream that you put in your coffee with a plant-based cream, because there's so many choices now, especially with the Elmhurst products, the cashew milk, or eventually the hemp cream or peanut cream, that's you're on your way. It's funny, just one thing at a time. And then when you start tasting a dip that normally has a cheese, but is actually now a nut cheese, and you're sitting there saying, you know, that's pretty doggone good. You know, this is a step, and more recipes. My favorite recipe for Belgian waffles is totally vegan.
What do you use in that?
Well, I'm using, I like using the oat milk in that, but for the egg white, I use the aquafaba that we developed.
Oh, you've developed an aquafaba there?
Yeah. And so, that's a fabulous thing. And so we're getting ready to launch that as well. And we're very excited about that, because it makes it easy. Whenever you want an egg whites, you can just kind of keep it in your cupboard, and you just open it up, pour it out, and whip it up, and you've got egg whites.
And you've sort of touched on this, but I believe you're based in upstate New York.
Correct. Just outside of Buffalo, which, you know, basically being on the Niagara grid with energy and hydropower, we couldn't get better.
And there's also a lot of dairy farms up in upstate New York. So I have, whenever I have written about non-dairy products, I've gotten a bit of hate from dairy farmers in upstate. And, you know, they are suffering economically. There's no doubt about that. And so you have touched on this, like, you do see a way for plant-based milks and for dairy milk to kind of coexist in one person's refrigerator. But do you think that are dairy and alternative milks in competition?
Actually, I don't. I see it as a necessary expansion. I just gave a talk yesterday in Syracuse to the New York State Association for Food Protection. So there were a lot of dairy people there. And I always worry about, here I am talking about plant-based foods, but I'm trying to educate them on the fact that these are nutritive. For years, people thought that by adding anything into dairy products, oh my gosh, you're degrading the nutritive value of the dairy. Well, not anymore. Not with these milked grains, nuts, and seeds. You're actually expanding the nutritive value. This is why, and people don't even really think that way. Think about it. About when you add dairy milk to oatmeal. Okay, well, you've expanded the value of the dairy milk. It's, which is more important, the oat or the cereal? The cereal or the dairy milk? Well, you know, they're both equally important. And that's where we're going. So even in, as we look at beverages, and of course, we're a very grab-and-go society, very busy, and people want convenience. But this is something that these milks, and that's what we're looking for, are doing ice creams that are not 100% dependent on just dairy milk, that these can be a combination without diminishing the nutritional value that the consumer is getting. And in fact, what we're doing is expanding it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's often difficult to kind of discuss plant-based foods. I know you're working from a scientific and technological and business perspective, but to talk about these foods and sustainability and food waste without also using a political framework, I don't know, do you believe your work in this field to be political in any way?
Oh, I, for some reason, anything you do these days seems to be political. I think only because it becomes political if people aren't willing to understand and put it in the correct framework, or a let's call it a larger framework. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking at to where we are now, we have to look at where we're going. And I think we sometimes get too involved with the situation that we're living in instead of thinking about, well, what is the future? What are the realities? The reality is population is expanding. Mm-hmm. Water is diminishing in many areas of the world. And yet we have the ability to stabilize foods, distribute foods internationally. Some people that have very good crops and yields should be able to distribute them. The political comes in is, why aren't they being distributed? Why can't we better equalize the distribution of our food and agricultural yields? I think that's the bigger question at the end of the day. Nothing should be wasted. Anything that can be grown, whether it's dairy or an agricultural crop, anything that can provide, it's a matter of processing it, getting it stabilized, and getting that nutritional value distributed.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell.
You're very welcome, Alicia.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Of course.